Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today we'll be talking about Democratizing Texas Politics, Race, Identity, and Mexican-American Empowerment, 1945 to 2002. The author of this book is Benjamin Marquez. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good. Thank you.
Yeah, it's such an interesting book. And before we get to it, maybe you could tell us just a little bit about yourself, what your background is, and where you've been and where you are now.
Well, right now I'm a professor of political science at the University of Wisconsin, and I'm currently the director. I'm also the director of the Chicano Latino Studies program here. But I am not from the Midwest. I was born in El Paso, Texas, many years ago. I got my BA at the University of Texas at El Paso. But interestingly, I came here to the University of Wisconsin to get my master's and my PhD. I've been at a number of institutions where I've taught and done research. I taught for a year at San Jose State University. I taught for a couple of years at the University of Kansas. I was also a professor for several years at the University of Utah, and then in 1991 I came back to my old alma mater in the Department of Political Science at the University of Wisconsin, and I've been here ever since. And
I was just going to say, we've had the real good fortune over the last 6 months or so to have a number of faculty members at University of Wisconsin, many talking about similar subjects. So there's clearly some good stuff going on in Madison right now.
Oh, I think so. This is a great university, and there are a lot of very creative and innovative people here. So it's a real joy to work at this institution.
Yeah, and you've produced a really interesting book. Partially a history of the state, a really interesting political history. You start your book in and around 1945. I wonder if you would briefly describe what the state of Texas looked like in the 1940s. What were its demographics? How similar was the state compared to today?
Well, that's one of the things that I should clarify that that the things that I write about are things that I've seen in my own life, and that I've been very curious about understanding more completely. I was growing up in Texas in the 1950s and 60s, and I saw many of the changes that I talk about in my book take place before my very eyes. And I knew something important was happening, but of course, you know, as a kid, as an adolescent, even a young adult, it really wasn't clear to me what it was exactly that was going on. And for example, the election of some of the first Mexican Americans to the state legislature, the election of more and more Mexican Americans to local and in one case national office. I was always curious about this phenomena, and later as I became an academic, you know, I wondered how can this be explained in larger terms. So I started my research, and many people see the post World War II period as a very significant time in our country's history. I picked that time as my starting point, although I could have gone back much earlier than that. I thought this was a good time to look and try to understand the changes that had taken place. If you look at Texas politics in the mid 1940s, right after World War II. One of the things that characterized it was its strict racial demarcation lines. Mexican Americans, African Americans were clearly marginalized, and in the case of African Americans, they were segregated by law. Mexican Americans were segregated not by law but by social custom, and sometimes enforced by violence, by the mid 1970s and then through the 80s, the state had begun to change, and the topic of my book is electoral change. How did Texas change in terms of electoral politics and representation? So in 1945, the state's electoral politics reflected these social realities. The electoral system was dominated by Southern Democrats. It was an all-white, very conservative, exclusive electoral system, and there was virtually no participation and no effective participation by racial and ethnic minorities. And by the 1970s, that had changed. We had not a one-party, a white one-party system in Texas, but we actually had a competitive two-party system that was racially integrated. I found that fascinating. I do find it fascinating. That's why I wanted to understand what had gone on. And then by the 2000s, we had a racially integrated two-party system dominated by the Republican Party, in which the Republican Party was partially integrated itself. So, you know, how did this happen? I wanted to know how in the world did this happen? Who did it? You know, who were the people that did it? Did it matter who did it? I think it did. And what were the implications of this change for racial power and racial representation? So that my questions expanded as I got older and learned a little bit more about politics and social change.
Yeah, and one of the most interesting figures in your book, of which there are many, is Henry B. Gonzalez. So who was Gonzalez, and what was his vision for empowering Mexican Americans in Texas politics?
I found Henry B. Gonzalez to be one of the most fascinating players in Texas politics for many years. And I should remind your listeners that Henry B. Gonzalez was active not just in the post-World War II period, actually prior to that. Before becoming a congressman in 1961, he was on the San Antonio City Council. And I think it's important to remember that, not to celebrate the man himself, but to understand the way that he looked at politics and understood racial representation. San Antonio currently has a very successful Mexican-American mayor, but some of the things that he believes in are considered quite controversial. But his beliefs, his views, and his attitudes actually go back long, long before that, and even before Henry B. Gonzalez. And I was one of the first scholars to have a look at his collected papers at the Center for American History at the University of Texas at Austin. And what I found really interesting about Henry B. Gonzalez was that he was both a Cold War liberal. He was very liberal when it came to domestic policies, very tough when it came to international policy, a strong supporter of the military. He was also a strong advocate for the Mexican American people. He fought for equal rights for everyone. He led a filibuster in 1948, the first year that he was a senator, against the segregation bills proposed by the Texas governor, who wanted to fight, you know, this was mid 1950s, who were doing everything they could to prevent the implementation of the Brown v. Board, the Supreme Court decision. They did everything they wanted to do to fight that. They could to fight the desegregation orders following that case. So he is an old-time liberal. He understood history. He understood where racial and ethnic disadvantages and inequalities were rooted, but yet he was a strong advocate of participating within the Democratic Party, and that meant participating within the Texas Democratic Party when it was still a largely racist and exclusionary political party. Why do that? Well, he said this was really the only route for change. As to use the Democratic Party as a vehicle, does that mean that you have to form alliances with people that you don't particularly like or who don't have your interests at heart? His answer was yes, but give me an alternative. That was always his question. And during the 1960s, I devote quite a bit of space to this period. He was attacked for being a sellout, and his question was always, you know, what would you suggest? What's your alternative? What's realistic? So I found him really fascinating in that way. And he's, you know, of course, he had his cantankerous personality. So there was very, very many aspects to him as a person that I just was fascinated by. But as a political player, he articulated the vision of creating a liberal, multiracial coalition dedicated to creating change through incremental means. I mean, he fully endorsed that.
Yeah, and his vision differed from some of his contemporaries. I wonder if you could describe who he most often conflicted with. And what other visions were out there for advancing the interests of Mexican Americans during the 1950s and up through the 1960s? Who were his primary adversaries during this time period?
Well, there's a number of individuals that were there, but I like to look at these debates as longstanding. And apart from the individuals who articulate them, his nemesis during the 50s and the 60s was Albert Pena. But he articulated a vision that continued through the 1960s and 70s and has not disappeared today. Basically, Albert Pena did not trust the Democratic Party. And ironically, Henry Gonzalez did not have a lot of faith in the state Democratic Party, but he thought that that eventually the national party would change the state party. But those that opposed the vision of people like Henry B. Gonzalez and a list of others that I mentioned in the book believed that there needed to be a stronger nexus, actually not a stronger nexus, but there needed to be organizing that was indistinguishable from that of party politics. In other words, they believed that party, Democratic Party advocates, and this is what they were, should also be community advocates as well. So they should be activists in both realms, and there should be no separation. In other words, in order to hold the Democratic Party accountable to Mexican Americans, you should also be a community activist. And ironically, when the race line was broken eventually in the Democratic Party, and this was a very complicated process, that division began to widen, and individuals who were long-time committed party activists or professional politicians came to win out. But the critique was that the Democratic Party would never be responsive to Mexican Americans, would always offer paltry compromises, those that would be ineffective in rooting out racism, rooting out socioeconomic inequalities. And again, Henry Gonzalez or individuals who of like mind would turn around and say, well, give us another way. Give us a realistic alternative. So that's a long-standing debate. And at that time, Albert Pena was the leading voice in opposition to Henry B. Gonzalez. But you could find individuals like that today.
Yeah, I think one of the real interesting aspects of the book, reading about this time period from where we are now, with quite weakened, particularly at the state and local level, weakened political parties, you have to sort of return back to a time period where this argument that Gonzalez makes, which is, you know, if, as you've mentioned several times, what is the other alternative? It's a very different, such a different time period. On page 76, and throughout the book, you have some excellent, excellent photographs. But on page 76, you have a great photograph of several leaders with Lyndon Johnson at the White House. I wonder if you could describe a little bit what the relationship was of the Mexican-American leaders with national figures like John Kennedy and then later Johnson.
Well, they were one of the first activists who actually had real contact with national leaders. And you have to put yourself in their shoes. This was a first, to actually visit the White House, to actually be photographed with the president was not a routine matter. It's not something that people do today. I'm sure there are thousands and thousands of photographs taken today of minority political activists with President Obama and other presidents. It's become routine, but this was a breakthrough, and this was a first. So they were very proud of this accomplishment, because they felt they accomplished it for their people. They thought this was a racial breakthrough, but at the same time, they were Democratic Party activists. And they presented themselves not only as representatives of a population that were in need, and they appealed to Johnson and Kennedy's sense of social justice, but also a group that was very important to the Democratic Party's coalition. And that's what they emphasized. They emphasized their importance in winning elections. And they would point to the 1960 presidential election. They would say, "Look, how is it that Johnson and Kennedy won the 1960 election?" Well, part of it was that Johnson was on Lyndon Baines Johnson was on the Democratic Party, was the vice presidential candidate. But the other was that community activism was translated into Democratic Party activism. The Viva Kennedy clubs. This was a network of Mexican American political activists who worked to get the vote out, the Mexican American vote out for the Kennedy Johnson ticket. But they were Democratic Party activists, so it was not hard for them to take off one hat and put on another. But really, their hearts they wanted to break through. These were individuals who wanted to be regular and respected participants in the Democratic Party, and they were left out. So when they talked to Johnson, when they talked to Kennedy, when they talked to any Anglo-Democratic Party official, they were speaking as members of this coalition because they understood the limits of racial group agitation in electoral politics. They said, this is the way you move the polity, and you have to work with others. You have to find a common ground, and you do that by finding common interests.
One of the nice things about the book is you know, this is a story about a state and about a particular part of a state, but it can be generalized to so many other situations, and many of the dynamics that are going on happen in other communities and other parts of the country. And one of the dynamics that you talk about a lot in the book is the emergence of these organizations. And so an organization called the Mexican American Youth Organization emerged in the late 1960s. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how politics changed as we moved from the 1960s to the 1970s and beyond, and how some organizations like the Mexican American Youth Organization sort of changed the dynamics of Texas politics from what you described earlier to the 70s and into the 80s.
Well, as you know, explaining social change is one of the most difficult things that we do. It's really hard to understand how change comes about. And as I try to do in the book, I point out that a lot of things came together to bring about change. But you're referring to some of the radical nationalist organizations and leaders of the 1960s and 70s, and groups like La Raza Unida Party. We're getting a lot of media attention, and I was in Texas at the time, and I was just fascinated by the groups. In fact, I participated with some of these groups, and we felt that we were changing state politics because as we were active, we saw the state changing, and we concluded that we had an awful lot to do with that. But even though the radicals, the nationalists of the 1960s and 70s got a lot of media attention, and boy, you go to the archives that I went to, and they're just chock full of these groups organizing. What I found was that the groundwork had already been laid in the 1940s and even before that, that people like Henry B. Gonzalez and others that I'd mentioned had been hard at work for a very long time, creating a space for minority voices in the Texas political party system. So they were already there. And in fact, they were distressed when they heard these young radicals, and they saw them actually step into the electoral realm, because they believed that they were upsetting a lot of their hard patient work. On the other hand, this was also an impetus for the Democratic Party to change and to integrate its ranks. So it could no longer stand guilty of the charge of racial exclusionism. So in other words, at the time when their work began to bear fruit, radicals were critiquing every aspect of American society, including the party system. And as a result, Anglo political leaders were given a choice. Well, you know, you either speed up the change of the pace of integration, or you have to deal with the withering critiques of these young radicals. So they did play a role, but I documented so many years of very hard and very patient work among Mexican-American Democrats, Democratic Party activists, to integrate the party, to make it more responsive, to make it more representative. And their work began to bear fruit just at the time at the rise of the Chicano movement. So many popular observers attribute that radicalism and that activism with changing the party. And it played a role, but the lion's share of the credit goes to people like Gonzalez and others who were patiently working the long hours to change the Democratic Party and to make it more inclusive.
Now, your book takes us up through 2002, but I wonder if you would sort of indulge us in the current state of Texas politics. How democratic, either small D or big D, is Texas politics today? Could you, sort of put the book into a little bit of, current politics context? Where do we stand today when we look at how democratized politics is in Texas?
Well, I chose the title. I mean, I called it "Democratizing Texas Politics," with deliberately. I mean, it's a wordplay, and this now this gets to the question of what exactly democracy means, what does representation mean, and what does that have to do with race? And let me give a historical example to illustrate what I mean by that. When I first started this project, I thought it was going to be just focused on the Mexican American Democrats, this one part of the Democratic Party, and I went to the University of Texas and found their newsletters, and a big stack of them. And for a researcher, this is just a gold mine. So I set up a table with all these newsletters in the library, and I started looking at them. And the next thing I knew, I wasn't finding anything. Where is the information? Where is the discussion of racial representation? Instead, there was list after list of political events, of barbecues, of reminders to do this, reminders to do that, and no advocacy in terms of legislation, other than to call attention to their members that certain bills were being considered. It was a kind of a dull affair for somebody who's looking for racial rhetoric or advocacy, racial advocacy, because by the end of the 70s and certainly into the 80s and then into the contemporary period, and that was your question now, Mexican Americans have been integrated, and they've been integrated in terms of policy priorities of their party. Their interests may be different in a larger sense. They've got historical grievances. They've got greater socioeconomic inequalities. They lag behind on any number of measures from the majority population. But their issues, their policies are those of the Democratic Party. So they've been captured, in other words. And this is where they operate now. One of the things that I found was that even the most ardent, the most left liberal Democrats who would get elected from places like South Texas and other concentrations where they had a large community base, found that they had to work within the structure. They had to work with other Democrats who didn't see things their way. They had to work within a context where the Republican Party was on the ascent and, in fact, has become dominant now. Most Mexican Americans are reliable Democratic voters. But until very recently, if you look at the last two presidential elections, this reversed a long time trend. The Republican Party was taking a bigger and bigger bite out of the Mexican American vote, and this was first articulated in the 1970s by the Republican Party. They said, we don't have to get a majority of their votes, but if we can take 18 to 20% of the vote, by God, we can win statewide elections, and that's what they've been doing. So Mexican American political struggles within the Democratic Party, and I'd like to emphasize the electoral angle on this, are those of the Democratic Party, and they become one and the same. That's how they're articulated.
The book was just so very interesting. I learned a lot from it, stuff that I didn't know about Texas, stuff that I didn't know about sort of larger, some of the changes that have gone on. I think the writing style, the archives that you use really add to a very interesting read. What's up next from you? I always like to ask authors if there's either a next phase of this project. Are you going to be doing 2003 to 2014 on the next project, or are you going to push out in some other directions? What might we have to look forward to?
Well, I'm starting a new book project. I'm writing and this is something new, both substantively as well as conceptually. I'm working on a book on the Mexican American Legal Defense and Education Fund. And this is a very different organization for the that I'm used to studying. This is a professional organization. It has no members. You can't join the Mexican American Legal Defense and Educational Fund. They're a small group of lawyers. They have perhaps 50 to 85 people working on staff with the organization at any given time. But yet, since the 1960s, and this is another group that had its roots in the 1960s, since the 1960s, it has been one of the most effective legal advocacy groups for Mexican Americans in the country. And one of the things that fascinates me, and this is a new project, I've just started it, and it presents all kinds of research problems, is that it has been very influential in many of the changes that I've just talked about, and it has influenced the course of social movements in many ways. But its work has been done in the legal system. Oftentimes enabling social movement organizations to be more successful, and at other times, because of their focus on equal rights, equal representation, equal application of social programs, and so forth, formal equality, it can sometimes shape the context within which social movements operate. And there's a fascinating literature on cause lawyering, on cause lawyers that I'm trying to apply here.
Well, it sounds really interesting. I can't wait for it to come out. I hope that you come back when it does. And until then, we can all read Democratizing Texas Politics, Race, Identity, and Mexican-American Empowerment, 1945 to 2002, published this year by University of Texas Press, available widely. Ben, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you so much, Heath.